This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. You need to understand the details of Russia purchasing the company Uranium One. This deal is in the news because of revelations there may have been a deal made between the Russians and the State Department, led at the time by Hillary Clinton. The extent to which that is true doesn't change the underlying reality that Russia now owns this company outright. This is a company that controls about 20% of America's uranium production capacity. Where is that uranium going? Well, this is very alarming, and it points to some significant prophecies that we need to watch. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this important subject. Next, we'll talk about a sting operation that concluded last week, busting up a human trafficking ring in several African countries and another that took place in Mexico. Over 500 slaves were freed. The trouble is, this represents just a tiny fraction of the people who are suffering as slaves, even sex slaves, in the world today, right now. This is a horrific problem. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about it and about the solution and how those slaves are about to enjoy their freedom. In our third segment, we'll look at the foreign language work of the Trumpet. Most of what we do is in English, and that makes us accessible to the world's 1 billion English speakers. But we actually can reach another billion people through our work in German, French, Italian, and several other languages. We're going to talk with our foreign language translation manager, Edwin Trables, about this exciting dimension to what we do at the Trumpet. And I'll conclude today's program with a few words about how to praise your children the right way. The wrong kind of praise actually discourages them. We're going to talk about how to motivate them through praise. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The facts of Russia's deal in purchasing Canada-based company Uranium One are truly concerning. This company controls about 20% of U.S. uranium production capacity, and Russia bought the company in stages between 2009 and 2013 during the Obama presidency. It has really alarming strategic implications, this deal. To talk about it, we have Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, why is uranium so important?
Well, uranium is a very important natural resource for a couple of reasons. I mean, one thing that comes to mind right away is just the clean energy aspect or the electrical power that can be generated from uranium. But I think the bigger deal that most people will spring to mind is that this is the technique you use to make atomic bombs. And that's one of the main reasons that any country that aspires to be a nuclear power needs to have a lot of uranium.
This shows Russia's intent to buy up as much of this as they can. What is Russia after here?
Right. Well, already Russia is the world's biggest nuclear power in terms of just sheer number of nuclear warheads, and it has a tremendous amount of uranium reserves right in its own country, but it's also trying to get a lockdown on uranium in other countries, especially former Soviet countries like Kazakhstan, but also Canada and the United States, with Russia's kind of unique compared to the United States in that its uranium agency is state-run. And so this state-run company is trying to gobble up mines across the world to get a lockdown on the nuclear power aspect.
So the deal itself, well, just tell us about the deal. This is obvious. Why is this coming up in the news right now? Why is everyone concerned about it now? This was done over a period of years and finalized 4 years ago.
Right. Well, the big thing that happened this month is Attorney General Jeff Sessions just announced that he'd approved for prosecutors at the Justice Department to start looking into allegations made against the Clinton Foundation on charges of corruption. I guess just to kind of give all our listeners a recap is because uranium is such a strategic national security asset, even though the U.S. doesn't have a state-run uranium company, the government still does need to approve a foreign power purchasing more than 50% of any company that controls U.S. uranium mines. Even though Uranium One was a Canadian company, they also control very strategic mines in Kazakhstan and up to 20% of the uranium production capacity in the United States. And so when Rosatom, that's the Russian nuclear agency, they bought 17% of Uranium-1 in 2009. But the next year, they wanted to buy a 51% stake. And so to do that, they needed approval from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Utah's Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and 9 government agencies, one of which was the State Department, which was then being run by Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And all those agencies gave Russia the approval they needed. And so obviously this scandal goes well beyond just Clinton herself. But what really started raising eyebrows is that several key officials from Uranium One had donated $145 million to the Clinton Foundation while this three-step process was going on. Mm-hmm. And then in 2005, Hillary Clinton's husband, Bill Clinton, had even traveled to Kazakhstan to meet with some officials from Uranium One and kind of talk about that this is something, a purchase that wanted to go through in the future. So they were already discussing the possibility of this purchase even before Clinton became head of the State Department. And then when she did become head of the State Department, her husband's foundation, he was running it at the time, got millions of dollars in money. And so now the Justice Department's just trying to make sure that there's no was no illegal corruption actions that took place in any of those transactions.
These types of to be able to actually prove a quid pro quo in a situation like that is very, very difficult, as far as I can understand. That it's easy to so obviously there was an exchange of money and this deal was made, but to say that this led to that, to find the smoking gun that shows, well, it was because of that money that the deal was made, that can be very difficult to prove. But what do you make of this larger point, not to let the Clintons off the hook entirely, but to think of 9 government agencies plus these commissions that you were talking about, presumably having some power to kibosh this deal, all saying, yeah, this seems totally fine. Russia owning a 51% stake in this strategically important company.
Right. And all 9 government agencies were under the umbrella of the Obama administration at the time. And so it's definitely had a certain political power that was in control when all this was happening. But as you said, any one of these 9 government agencies could have put a monkey wrench in this deal and saying that, no, actually, we don't want to allow Russia to buy a company that controls 20% of our uranium reserves. It's quite shocking when you think about it. And
What are some of the problems that could result from this? Just giving it the common sense test.
Right. Well, even the head of the Russian nuclear agency had bragged to Vladimir Putin right afterwards that he's like, wow, it was like a few years ago, I never thought I'd see the day when Russia controlled 20% of America's uranium capacity. And so that's just kind of one of the first things that pops up for like a common sense problem is just the boon this is to the Russian economy. Mm-hmm. and all the money that can be made from this.
And making money off uranium, how do they do that? Where is this going? Who are the customers? What is the business exactly?
Right. Well, the U.S. uranium mines that you're making it would be making off selling domestically to other U.S. companies. Mm-hmm. And so you mine U.S. uraniums, who sell to another company, and then Russia makes money off that. Currently, there is a quid pro quo that Russia is not supposed to export any U.S. uranium out of the country unless they're sending it to Canada for further refinement. Although there's been some evidence that some of that uranium that's left Canada has already made its way from Canada to Europe. So there is a leak that they've kind of been able to circumvent that restriction. And that's something a lot of the defenders of the uranium deal try to really hit hard. It's like, well, they can't export U.S. uranium. But the bigger point is that the U.S., because there's 20% of U.S. uranium at stake here, the U.S. could have put a veto on the purchase of Russia buying Uranium One at all. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't, they bought the a couple years after U.S. made this decision in 2013, they didn't buy a 51% stake. They bought 100% stake. They bought the entire company. Mm-hmm. And so now they control 20% of the uranium in the United States, but also their mines in Canada and even more importantly, their mines in Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm. Which the U.S. officials were very aware of at the time that they made that decision.
Right. Bill Clinton traveled to Kazakhstan in 2005 to talk about the preliminaries for this deal. And there is, even though there might be some legal restrictions on exporting uranium from the U.S., there is no restrictions on exporting uranium from Kazakhstan. And actually, the Russian Rosatom just gave 130,000 tons, but a lot of uranium anyway, in January to Iran. And then the very next month, Iran's put in a request for 950 tons of uranium from Kazakhstan, some of which may end up coming from those mines that Uranium One controlled. And so this is kind of a lockdown that Russia's state-run agency now controls these mines in the United States and in Canada and in Kazakhstan. And they've already have a very long history of they built Iran's first uranium refining plant. Russia built that for them. Have been exporting uranium to Iran and plan now to be exporting more uranium to Iran. And of course, Russia was one of those five main negotiators on the Iran nuclear deal that legitimized Iran's so-called peaceful uranium refinement programs. And so for those who are concerned that there's not UN regulators aren't supervising them like they were before the deal, that Iran's doing some underhanded stuff with North Korea and Syria to actually produce weaponized uranium, which there's a ton of evidence for. There could very well be using uranium for these weapons that they bought from Russia's nuclear weapons agency from mines in Kazakhstan that Russia was only able to buy because the U.S. government approved the sale of this company.
And we would look at Iran's nuclear development and their being able to make use of these uranium reserves as the probably the number one strategic concern in terms of the ramifications, the ripple effects of this deal having been made, I would assume.
Right. I mean, there's obviously economic concerns and concerns about Russia being able to circumvent sanctions over Crimea with deals like this. But I mean, that's the biggest thing that would keep someone up at night is that the United States sold a uranium company to Russia that they're now using mines from to give uranium to Iran to make a nuclear weapon that presumably with all their chance of death to America, some of these radical mullahs are thinking about using against the West.
So there are really, it seems, two issues here. There's obviously the question of corruption that Jeff Sessions is pursuing into in terms of the Clinton Foundation actually having an exchange of cash for purchasing rights. But it seems like in some ways the bigger issue is just one of strategic stupidity.
Right. I mean, I'd actually be kind of surprised at this point if they do end up levying any corruption charges, whether the corruption happened or not. But like you said, there just is this issue of that even if everything was completely legal, why on earth would you sell 20% of your uranium to a foreign power and approve the sale of mines in Kazakhstan that Russia had a long history before this deal took place of using similar mines to give the material you make nuclear weapons from to a rogue state that's pledged to wipe you from the face of the earth.
So looking at this from a biblical prophecy standpoint, obviously we talk quite a bit about just the prophecies that relate to nuclear warfare being a reality that we're going to be facing really soon. And so we're obviously very concerned about the proliferation of nuclear technology. And this definitely feeds into that. Looking at it, say, from the standpoint of the specific players involved, what do you make of America doing this deal with Russia?
Right. From a Bible prophecy standpoint, this is just kind of like a vortex of a lot of prophecies. It's almost hard to pick which one you want to focus on in a 15-minute program, because now we've covered on this program, for those who've listened to us for a while before, about prophecies like in Daniel 11, about that there's going to be this king of the south that's going to push at a king of the north in Europe and be the trigger that starts World War III.
Right.
And so in some ways, just the fact that, I mean, all the way back in like 1994, if not before, Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury had identified Iran as the leader of this radical Islamic movement in the Middle East that's fulfilling that prophetic role of King of the South. And so anything that the U.S. government's doing to help them get more uranium with this Iranian nuclear deal and now with this Uranium One scandal is just pushing, empowering Iran to get those nuclear weapons and start the last world war, or the World War III, which is extremely prophetic. We also, I think it's still our most popular or most requested book of the year, is the Prophesied Prince of Russia booklet, where Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury goes through prophecies in Ezekiel 38, where he says, set your face against the prince of Rosh. And that verse also mentions Meshach and Tubal, which like students of Bible history will know that Rosh is just an ancient word for Russia. Meshach and Tubal are both localities within Russia. And so when you combine those prophecies, as the booklet explains, with some others about Ezekiel 27, about this Tubal being part of a great trade alliance in the world, and Revelation 9 about these kings in the east with a 200 million man army, we know that Russia also is prophesied to rise to a world power status, and giving them 20% of your uranium reserves is a good way to help a nation like Russia rise to world power status. I mean, I think they probably control more uranium than any other nation on the world at this point.
And what about just the, I guess, the ineptness of U.S. policy? It is remarkable, it seems like, I guess, having just seen Donald Trump head over to Asia and the way that he was interacting with Vladimir Putin and all of the headlines about Russian interference in American elections and hacking and all of this, that Donald Trump was still very deferential to Vladimir Putin. And he was very outspoken in saying, well, you know, this man, I believe he sincerely believes that they didn't have anything to do with that. It seems like there's this credulity on the part of American officials toward Russia and Vladimir Putin in particular, where it's like there is just a lack of recognition of the strategic threat we have here.
Right. That is Putin in particular is quite amazing in that way, is that he really had pretty good relations with President Bill Clinton and President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama and President Donald Trump. I mean, Hillary Clinton's probably most famous for that, is that she actually just took out a yellow box with a big red button on it and called it a reset button. Other presidents, other presidential administrations haven't been quite that blatant, but almost every presidential administration for the last couple decades has had like a reset policy with Russia.
So how does that fit in with prophecy?
And there is definitely one prophecy we've pointed to a lot is Leviticus 20:16, with like the blessings and the cursings, that God said that if the, not just the leaders, but if the people turned away from God's laws, that he would break the pride of the power of the nation. And some of it now that, I mean, ideally America would trust God to as its protector and its defender. And then for a good part of the 20th century, they've kind of gotten away from the trusting God, like maybe the founding fathers or Abraham Lincoln would have done, and gotten more towards trusting the Pentagon and their military might. But now, like I said, that prophecy of the breaking the pride of the power, that they don't even really trust their own might anymore. And they're just trying to curry favor with these foreign powers like China and like Russia, and in some ways even Iran, the Trump administration less than the Obama administration. But it kind of just brings this image that you're giving this uranium to Russia in hopes that you'll buy influence with Russia, and you're making this our nuclear deal with Iran, that in fact that, well, if we're nice to them, maybe they won't hate us so much. And it does really bring, actually, I guess, one last prophecy. We've covered quite a few already in this program, just in Ezekiel 16, where God's really coming in, that highlighting the fact that he had like a marriage covenant with the nations descended from Israel. But now that these nations are looking to foreign powers, it's almost like adultery or harlotry. And actually that verse does use that term. So they said it is, you're like an adulterous wife who doesn't trust God or her husband to defend her anymore, but looks to nations like Russia and like Iran to be their defender. And said because they've done that, that's going to backfire on them spectacularly, as these nations, they never really loved you, and they turn against you in the future.
Well, powerful stuff. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about Russia buying up Uranium One, the Canada-based company that owns 20% of America's uranium reserves. You can find the booklets that we just talked about, The King of the South, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, on thetrumpet.com under the Literature tab. You can also find a video that Andrew has produced called Why Russia Wants to Control the World's Uranium Supply. He goes through some of these points. You can find that on the front page of thetrumpet.com. Andrew, that's really explosive material. We appreciate you bringing it to us.
Yeah, always great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In a huge international sting operation last week, some 500 victims of human trafficking were rescued, including 236 children. The slavery was taking place in several African nations. And then another operation in Mexico rescued 30 women from sex trafficking. These incidents drew attention to the ongoing problem of slavery in our world. This isn't something that was eliminated generations ago. It's been happening throughout human history, and it continues to happen. It's not something most of us think very much about, but it is a very real problem in today's world. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there.
This is a tough subject to think about, but tell us the details of these latest operations that we were talking about.
Sure, yes. This African operation took place in Chad, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, and Senegal. And it led to the arrest of 40 suspected human traffickers, most of whom were women, which is pretty interesting in this case. But it actually is sort of a time-honored practice in the prostitution industry to have women do a lot of the recruiting and a lot of the ensnaring of other women and young girls, just because a vulnerable young woman who's homeless or a young girl who's homeless and probably hungry, they're much more likely to be receptive to the propositions, I guess, of another woman than they would be to a man. And so it's just another layer of really sad deception that's a part of this story. But they were largely female traffickers that had ensnared some 500 different victims here. And as you mentioned, 236 of those were children. And so this sting operation happened across five countries basically simultaneously so that they were able to prevent them from communicating from one hub to another. Mm-hmm. And it was funded by the German Foreign Office and coordinated by Interpol. So it was a massive operation. But I was able to speak this morning with a gentleman in Senegal, and he said that this was a wonderful development, but it was really just a drop in the bucket. Mm. I've got a quote from him here. He said, it's great news, but it was only a drop in the bucket. I live in Senegal, and at least half of the kids on our block, and most blocks in my neighborhood, fit this description. My city alone has literally thousands of children who have been sent to Quranic schools by assumedly well-intentioned poor parents in the countryside, where they memorize the Quran in Arabic, which they don't speak, in exchange for spending the rest of their day begging in the streets for coins or rice or sugar to bring to their master, if they want to avoid a beating. They have no parents in their lives, they have no childhood, and they have no meaningful hope of education. These are not hidden cases here. This is a generally accepted system in one of the most stable countries in Africa. Mm. So just a really heartbreaking account. He says it's wonderful that Interpol and the German Foreign Office coordinated this and funded this operation, but it's the problem is so endemic and just so widespread that it's difficult to see how a meaningful end or solution to this could be brought about.
So you say 500 people rescued in this operation in Africa, 30 in Mexico. What sort of scale are we talking about with how many people are affected by human trafficking and sex trafficking to where, you know, what percentage of the whole does, say, this one operation represent? If 500 people were rescued, how many were not rescued for everyone who was?
Yeah, the numbers really do prove that the gentleman in Senegal there was exactly right. The International Labor Organization estimates that in 2016, there were 40.3 million men, women, and children around the world who are victims of slavery right now. And so that's it's a huge number. That's more than three times the total number of Africans who were shipped to the Americas during the entire 360 years of the New World slave trade. And that's people right now. You know, it's just that's just a snapshot. So,
and how widespread geographically are we talking about? Is this is basically every country on Earth?
Yes. Yes, it is everywhere on Earth. Africa has the highest rate of modern slavery, 7.6 per 1,000 people in Africa are estimated to be enslaved right now. In Asia, it's 6.1 per 1,000 people. In Europe and Central Asia, it's 3.9 per 1,000. And then in the Americas, it's 1.9 per 1,000. So it is all around the globe. It's much higher percentages, of course, in Africa and Asia than elsewhere, but it's still pretty much in all corners of the earth.
So what does the... who are the victims of this primarily? It seems like women and children are disproportionately targeted.
That's exactly right. The International Labor Organization says that traffickers almost always prey on the more vulnerable. So 71% of all victims are female, and a little more than 25% are children. So that just shows that they're almost always going after those who are more vulnerable.
But then you also have the issue, say you were talking about these young people in Senegal who are being told to memorize the Quran or they're going to be beaten, children who are being recruited into terrorist armies, and they're basically foot soldiers within some of these terrorist organizations as well.
That's another part of it that this International Labor Organization report would not even cover. But that's true. There's a lot of coercion and forced labor of all kinds that wouldn't be included in this report. And it just shows how many abysmal circumstances there are for children in many pockets of the world.
So to hear, to read headlines about Interpol intercepting this one particular operation that was going on and saving 500 people's lives, in some ways, we're talking about a problem that's on a scale that really is beyond the reach of any international policing agency to make much of a difference in the lives of. You're talking about more than 40 million people who are being affected by this every day. How do we view this just in light of what the Bible says about this? What does it say about what kind of hope these folks might have who are experiencing these kinds of conditions?
Well, that's a great question. It does prove that slavery is not just a scourge of the past. You know, it's in our country. It's maybe in Oklahoma City nearby here. Most likely the statistics would bear that out. So it's so endemic that it would be very difficult for it to be, well, it would be impossible for it to be rooted out by anything short of a global revolution. Mm-hmm. It's such a deep evil that it wouldn't be cured by anything short of that. But the Bible does say that very mercifully, exactly such a revolution is on the horizon. When Jesus Christ was here on earth, he witnessed some extremes of human suffering, and he relieved that suffering among those who he healed, and among some of those who he preached to personally. But he also made clear that he was not on earth at that time to use his power to overthrow the existing world order. You can look in Matthew 25, verses 51 through 52, or John 18:36, and it shows that I'm not here right now to overthrow the world and to clean everything up. But he did promise to return in power and in glory. And at that time, he promised that he would obliterate all injustice. There's one particularly inspiring prophecy about this. It's recorded in Psalm 12, verse 5, and it says, this records God saying, "I have seen violence done to the helpless, and I have heard the groans of the poor. Now I will rise up to rescue them as they have longed for me to do." Mm-hmm. That's the New Living Translation. But really, that's the hope that we have to hold on to with this situation. There's nothing short of that global revolution that will really cure this problem for all of the poor who are groaning and the helpless who have had violence done to them, as mm-hmm. the scripture says.
Yeah, you know, it makes me think, too, of just how there are prophecies of the time just ahead, the Great Tribulation and the very catastrophic conditions that are going to be pervasive among all nations very soon. And it talks quite a lot about slavery in that context, the fact that people are going to be buying and selling children, that it'll be, you know, a bottle of wine will get you a slave girl or that type of thing. Just horrific lack of regard for human life. And on a much larger scale than we see even today, even whole peoples, including the peoples of the United States, going into captivity. So this is definitely a trade that in the short term is actually a bull market, that it's actually going to grow substantially. But that one prophecy that you mentioned there, that really is, there must be 100 passages like that in the Bible that show that God does not stop his ears to those cries, that he's very aware of the suffering that is taking place in the world today. One would wish that those who are going on about the slavery that took place in the United States 200 years ago would be more concerned about the slavery that's going on right now, and that human beings would be taking greater steps to try to put an end to that slavery today. But God certainly does. He is very aware of it and does promise that he's going to take care of it.
Yes, that's exactly right. As you said, the scripture that I read there was just one of numerous scriptures showing that God has a very personal interest in, especially someone who's weaker being oppressed by someone who's stronger. Mm-hmm. And so it is really comforting to read those passages that promise that justice will be done and all those victims will be liberated and freed. And based on these and other Bible prophecies, world-renowned educator Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, he was the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet's forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, and he wrote a book called The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. And it does an amazing job of just painting a picture of what that world will look like once Christ returns and liberates all those who are currently oppressed. Here's one quote from The Wonderful World Tomorrow. It says, "All crime and organized rebellion will be put down by force. Divine supernatural force. See now a glimpse into the world of no illiteracy, no poverty, no famine and starvation, into a world where crime decreases rapidly, people learn honesty, chastity, human kindness, and happiness, a world of peace, prosperity, abundant well-being." And it is a booklet that we have available for free on our website. So if any listeners would like to get a copy of that, you just have to go to thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab there. And this is a book that really helps us to see the good news that is coming so quickly, and really the only real solution to this problem of the modern global slave trade.
Jeremiah has an article that's up on the website today called "Modern Slavery is Booming in Africa, Mexico, and Beyond." Any other resources that you might point people to if they were interested in learning more about this?
Yes, in our February 2014 print edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet, we have an article called "Coming Soon, Freedom for Slaves." And this one does, it just puts everything into the biblically prophetic context, and it shows the big picture of how deep the problem is. And then more recently in our September print edition from this year, there's a very powerful article. It's called "The World Needs Justice." So either of those would really give this a lot of important context.
Well, we appreciate that, Jeremiah. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the subject of human trafficking and slavery. It's happening in the world today, and it's going to end very, very soon. We appreciate your time, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
There are about 1 billion people on Earth who speak English as a first or second language. That's a lot of people. But there are 7.6 billion people on Earth. The radio station or the podcast you're listening to is in English, obviously. The Trumpet magazine is published in English, the literature that we offer. but we actually make an effort to reach at least a good portion of those 6.6 billion other people who don't speak English through our Foreign Language Translation Department. And I wanted to share with you some news about these efforts. To talk about this, we have from our office in Edstone, England, the Trumpet's Foreign Language Translation Manager, Edwin Trables. Hello, Edwin.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I appreciate you joining us. And this is some exciting news. It's an exciting part of what we do, and one that probably a lot of Trumpet readers or Trumpet radio listeners would not be aware of. Maybe you could just start by giving us a sense of the scope of the foreign language work, some of the activities that we're involved in order to reach those folks.
The Philadelphia Church of God, we publish translations in 9 languages. So we do German, French, Dutch, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, Finnish, Norwegian, Afrikaans, and we even started working on Hebrew, but we've been publishing in all the other languages.
Okay, and how much do you publish in those languages? Obviously, we produce a whole lot of material between radio, video, and editorial content, magazines, booklets, books. How much of that actually makes it into those other languages?
Yeah, we translate and publish about 1.5 million words every year, which to wow. understand it a little bit better, perhaps, it's about 2 King James Bibles every single year.
Yeah. So it's a whole lot of stuff. Do you have a sense of, like, say, what's the percentage of the English language material that we produce that actually makes it into those other languages?
Yes, I do. It's a little bit hard to tell because it's hard to measure everything. If you just look at the literature, we have about over 2 million words available in English in literature alone, and we have about 7 million words available in the foreign languages. So that doesn't mean that we have everything or more. We have about a third of the literature available.
Yeah.
And we, instead of producing one video, a large video every week, we do it once a month in some of those languages. So mm-hmm. so we can't quite keep up with everything, but we certainly take a good stab at it.
Well, give us a sense of how much effort, man hours, staffing goes into this, because it does obviously takes a whole lot of work to do that, but we don't necessarily have a whole lot of resources to devote to it. What all goes behind it?
Well, that's right. Only a handful of employees translate part-time and who are actually on the payroll. But for all the languages, we have almost 50 volunteer translators from 17 different countries from all over the world. Of course, the United States, UK, but even places like Austria, South Africa, Chile, El Salvador, Mexico, Suriname, Italy, and several other countries, the Netherlands and France and so on. And they really do... They're a very dedicated group of people. They support the message, and they really do sacrifice a lot of their own hours into this challenging work. And it's quite challenging because, of course, you have the issue of translating the original meaning word for word, but then also we want to make sure that it sounds like a native speaker. So there's quite a challenge ahead for those people every day for some of those people who depending on what they work on.
How much do modern tools like Google Translate, translation tools where there's automatic translation, how much does that help the process? I mean, there are certainly I've tried to use those tools quite a bit, and there are definitely deficiencies, but it's quite remarkable how effective they can be, at least giving you a baseline translation.
That's certainly true. They've come a long way over the last several years in particular. But unfortunately, if you use those a lot, and especially even of a base foundation for translation, sometimes the issues that creep up are actually very difficult to detect because they are actually so good, but they're also so wrong. So it's quite a challenge. So the human element is actually really essential. And also the native speaking part of it is quite essential. So we do usually only have people translate to their native tongue if we can.
Right, because we all know what it is like to try to read an instruction manual that was written by a Chinese company and translated through some automatic translation into English. There's quite often a lot of really humorous malapropisms and difficulties.
That's right. That's right. And since our a lot of our articles and such, they have quite a serious message to proclaim, it's definitely something that we need to be careful of, because certain nuances can creep in unfortunate ways.
So for a long time, we were publishing quarterly editions of the Trumpet magazine in many of these languages that you mentioned. We've kind of moved away from that. Maybe you could just tell us what's happening, say, in the last year or so with Trumpet translation.
Yes, that's right. We used to publish the Spanish, German, French, and the Italian trumpet magazines, but currently we just do the Spanish magazine. We still do that, so we do that 6 times a year still. And with the other languages, we've moved towards the websites mainly. The websites, they've given us a really great platform to reach a lot of people. We were reaching a few thousand people with the magazines, but that has multiplied quite significantly with the website. So we do try to have new articles online available in German, French, Spanish, and Dutch every business day. So we do, or as at least as regularly as possible. And we try to provide that. And we also maintain Facebook and Twitter posts to really try to keep people informed as quickly as we can, as well as that's actually a big part of it. To have
right. That's really important. That's outstanding manner. Because when you were talking about a quarterly publication with the articles that appear in the Trumpet, we're really trying to stay as up to date as possible and give people the understanding of the latest news, the latest events that are occurring in the world and what their prophetic significance is. And something might not appear in a quarterly publication for months after it actually occurred and we then wrote about it. So for us to be able to reduce that turnaround and to provide that understanding in a matter of days rather than months, that's a huge advantage for us.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's really fantastic. And we can respond to major events. If we have been watching a trend for a long time and something something big happens, or even an election, we can report on that very quickly within several days nowadays.
Okay, so you mentioned these websites. Those all just went online fairly recently, didn't they?
That's right. We started with the German website as a test, and that's been running for nearly 2 years now. But over the last year, we've added especially the Spanish, French, and Dutch websites. But also, we also have websites in all the other languages. And the other languages don't have regular articles go online, but we do have the literature that we have in those languages. And we also have an About Us and a contact page and so on. So people can find out about us very easily through those websites. And we also have email newsletters that people can sign up for. So we're just a lot more in touch with people nowadays.
So if people wanted to find those websites, how could they do so?
They can go to the English, thetrumpet.com, and go to the literature page. And if you go to that full literature library, you can change the language. And when you do that, it will take you to the foreign version.
Okay. So all of those websites. Well, you mentioned the one that you're really trying to put articles up on a regular basis, even daily basis. How much are you tailoring, say, which of those articles you're translating according to the audience? Like, say, are you focusing the news about what's happening in Germany for that German-speaking audience, that type of thing?
Yes, we definitely keep that in mind whenever we translate. Especially since we only have limited resources in what we can translate, we do definitely pick what we believe is most interesting to readers in those languages. It's a little tricky sometimes because each language, certain languages are spread out all over the world. Like French is a good example, but for the most part, we focus on the French French, and as well as the Canadians. So we do try to have articles specifically for those areas in particular, and for Germany, of course, Germany, and then European Union, and articles on Russia. And it's the same for the Dutch, who are, of course, close to Germany.
And you're also translating Key of David programs, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, and getting some of those videos that he's producing into those other languages.
That's right. The Key of David's are really neat. It's done differently in different languages, but in German, Spanish, and French, we do voiceover, so that we do actually have a specific translator who will do the voice, and that is overlaid on top of Mr. Gerald Fleury's video. And
yeah, Dutch, it's amazing to see Mr. Fleury speaking perfect French.
Yes, it's really quite remarkable. He enjoyed it himself as well when he saw that.
Right.
We also do subtitles in Dutch because that's more the common thing to do in the Netherlands. So that is just the English voice with Mr. Gerald Fleury and then the Dutch subtitles.
So give us an idea of the marketing campaigns that you've done to try to boost the audiences in these different languages and what kind of results you're getting.
Right. We do engage in some of the latest strategies in digital marketing. We of course, have an email newsletter people can subscribe to, but people can also go to the YouTube channels for those languages or follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And we also have advertisements on those platforms, on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. And we try to reach people that way, and that's proven to be very, very successful. And we've seen some very good results and really large surges of attention on those materials.
Mm-hmm. And so just an idea of what the reach is now or how much it's gone up this last there's really been these latest efforts maybe over the last couple of years you mentioned, beginning with the German language website. What kind of results are we getting?
Right. So we had a few thousand magazine subscribers, but this year alone, just in 2017, we had a total amount of people visit the German, French, Spanish, and Dutch websites of 100,000 people. So 100,000 people visited those four language websites, which is just a huge increase. And then they watched about 300 pages, and they also downloaded and ordered well over 10,000 pieces of literature.
That's marvelous.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And of course, the returning visitors, people who come back regularly, that number fluctuates, but that's also been increasing. And like I said earlier, we do have really large surges around big events such as elections, big developments in major trends, as well as more negative events like terrorist attacks.
So if you wanted to give anybody any more information, if people were interested in looking into that, or maybe they wanted to order some of that literature, you mentioned how to get them onto the website, the foreign language websites from the Trumpet site. Is there anything else that you would give just in terms of a call to action to people?
You can always just contact the English website if you're really struggling to find it all. Some of those websites have very foreign names, of course. I can mention one. The German one is deposauna.de. So that's a deposaune.de, deposauna.de. That's the German one. I won't get into all the other ones. There's a lot of them. But if you are struggling to find a specific language, or if you know of somebody who might need one of those languages, then you're always welcome to just contact the EnglishTrumpet.com website, and then we can always direct you or your friend to the correct website.
Well, that is marvelous. We've been talking with Edwin Trables about our foreign language work. He's the Trumpet's foreign language translation manager. Exciting stuff, Edwin. We sure appreciate you sharing that with us.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's time for today's last word.
This past weekend, I took my son to his first gymnastics meet, and it was a terrific event. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was very exciting and enjoyable. I love seeing boys working hard and performing these challenging high-skill tasks. One thing that bothered me, though, was a particular sound I heard at the conclusion of the event, and that was the jangling of metal. For most events, every child received a medal. For each one of the six events that they participated in, they got a medal. So they had quite a cache of hardware at the end of this event, not just gold, silver, and bronze for first, second, and third place. They gave medals for fourth place, for fifth place, sixth place, in some cases up to 11th place and beyond. I remember a few years ago, I brought my two daughters to a gymnastics meet where every single participant got a gold medal. Well, it was plastic, but a gold medal for each event and a trophy just for showing up. And at that meet, there were several first-placed winners because they were grouped by age. The 6-year-olds had their first-place winner, the 6.5-year-olds, the 7-year-olds, 7.5, 8, 8.5, and so on. I was reminded of a recent high school graduation I attended where there were 14 valedictorians and 17 salutatorians. This is life in America today. We treat our children's self-esteem like it's so fragile that it will perish if it's not put in intensive care on a feeding tube of sugary messages. You're the best. At what point did we decide that it was necessary for every child to leave every sporting event feeling like they had a Michael Phelps scale triumph? Proverbs 26 and verse 28 says, "A flattering mouth works ruin." And maybe there's nowhere where this is more true than with our children. Back in the 1990s, there was an interesting set of experiments conducted. 400 10 to 12-year-olds from a variety of backgrounds were given an intelligence test where they had to deduce and predict patterns among sets of various shapes. And when these kids finished, the experimenters told all of them, regardless of their performance, that they had done really well. They got 80% of the puzzles correct. But then there was a twist. 1/3 of these children received no other feedback. Another third was encouraged with one sentence of praise, essentially saying, "You must have tried really hard to have received such a good score." The final third of these kids was flattered with one sentence saying, "Wow, to have done so well on that test, you must be really smart." Now, that third group, that's basically what parents and educators tell our kids all the time. Now, what do you suppose happened? These same kids were given a choice after that between two further tasks. One task, they were told, would be tough, and they might not succeed, but they would still learn something from it, even if they failed. The other task was easy, and they'd probably succeed at it, but they wouldn't learn anything. Now, what's interesting is the children who had been flattered chose the easy task far more than the children who hadn't received that flattery. Tell a kid he's intelligent, and suddenly he wants to avoid a challenge and just stick to the easy stuff. The experimenters then gave these same children another set of puzzles. Now, these were far harder than the first, and most of the children did poorly on this test. Interviews afterward revealed that the flattered children, these kids that had only heard a single sentence praising their intellect, they enjoyed the difficult puzzles far less than the other children, and they were much less likely to want to do more of those puzzles in the future. So tell a kid that he's unusually bright, and suddenly he finds a lot less pleasure in taking on a difficult task. Now, all of these children were then told to tell their classmates how they had done on the difficult test. And get this, nearly 40% of the flattered children lied about their grade, almost 4 times as many as the other children. You tell a kid he's smart, and suddenly he becomes far likelier to bluff about his achievements. And finally, these children were given a third test. It was just as easy as the first. And what happened? Even though all the children had scored about the same the first time, this time the flattered children had a far lower score than their peers. So you tell a kid he's a brain, and then when he fails, he loses his motivation and feels helpless. Now guess what? The children who had been praised for their effort, not just flattered, but praised for their effort, actually performed the best of all. Where only 45% of the flattered kids chose the difficult task over the easy one, 65% of those who had been told nothing chose that route, but 90% of those who had been given just one sentence of encouragement took the hard route. The encouraged children also found the difficult test more enjoyable, and they were a whole lot likelier to want to do more challenges like that. And when they were given a test comparable to the first, they performed significantly better than they had the first time. All of that because of one sentence of the right kind of praise. What a lesson. Wrong praise can devastate a child's motivation. Stay away from praising your child for some supposed innate ability. You're so smart. You're so talented. Those statements are a trap. Proverbs 29 and verse 5 says, "A man that flatters his neighbor or his child spreads a net for his feet." But praising a child for his effort can really encourage him to stretch himself, to work hard, and then when the going gets tough, to keep at it. So when your child participates in something, don't strangle his neck with cheap medals and a slap a plastic trophy in his hand. Don't talk to him like he's a natural-born Olympian. Look for effort. And when you see that, encourage it. And when he brings home a good grade, talk about how it reflects fine work, solid study habits, concentration under pressure. When he scores an athletic success, praise his diligence or his teamwork or his tenacity in the face of a challenge. Make it specific. And keep it honest. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to my guests on the program today, Andrew Miller, Jeremiah Jacques, and Edwin Trables. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Jesse Hester. And I'll leave you with this thought from James Matthew Barry. The secret of happiness is not in doing what one likes, but in liking what one has to do. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.